This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 24, 2004. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The pre-trial for Guantanamo Bay detainees begins today as journalists and human rights groups are allowed limited access to the proceedings. The resistance in Iraq continues as two ministers are attacked with car bombs. We'll check in with central Baghdad. And a custody battle in Texas where a politician seeks to take custody of his African maid's child.
I have never in my almost 10 years of practice seen a child removed from their parent without a hearing and given to a non-relative, non-custodial person.
But first, these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Israeli Attorney General said he believes his government should finally refer to operations in the Palestinian territories as an occupation and fall in line with international law. Leila El-Haddad has more from Gaza.
The recommendation comes in the wake of an International Court of Justice ruling last month against the legality of the West Bank separation wall. If implemented, the move would mean Israel formally acknowledges its long-standing occupation of the Palestinian territories. Israel has so far chosen not to apply the Geneva Convention, which governs the treatment of civilians in occupied lands, to the Gaza Strip and West Bank, arguing they were never sovereign territories to begin with, and thus not occupied territories. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, Israeli occupation forces rounded up more than 300 Palestinian males between the ages of 16 and 50 and formally arrested at least one in a sweep of the West Bank refugee camp. Witnesses said Israeli tanks and troops surrounded the Asqar refugee camp and detained all males for questioning in a United Nations school. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Leila El-Haddad.
Activists gathered today to raise awareness that the vestiges of slavery still exist and that reparations are the answer. Grace Anderson reports from D.C.
A leading organization in the reparations movement is calling attention to the existing legacy of slavery. Pan-African Roots, a group that organizes emancipation commemorations, remembrances of Marcus Garvey's birthday, and other events of the civil rights movement, gathered today to discuss the importance of gaining access to private documents to prove that slavery existed in the 1800s. Bambose Shango with Pan-American Roots expressed a message of hope.
A better world, a reconcilable world, is possible, but it must begin with the truth, with rehabilitation, with redemption, with repatriation and reparation.
Pan-African Roots is demanding reparations for the victims of the slave trade and colonialism, which may come in from the restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, and measures which guarantee non-repetition. They are also challenging Republican National Chair Ed Gillespie in order to reaffirm their commitment to the 1850 Republican National Platform. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Grace Anderson.
1,700 healthcare workers are on strike at the nation's oldest HMO in Washington. Sarah Turner with the Workers Independent News Service has the story.
SEIU District 1199 Northwest called the strike in response to company demands that employees' premium costs increase by 12%. Group Health is deflecting criticism by saying the strike will only hurt patients and is unwilling to pay for its nurses' medical care. However, company officials say they are willing to hire replacement nurses at $50 an hour. Chris Barton is a 30-year veteran nurse and secretary treasurer of the local.
The amount of money that is being spent on the whole effort of trying to maintain patient care during a strike is phenomenal. So it's pretty clear to us that this is not just an economic issue also for the employer. This is one in which they want to change the whole dynamic of how people pay for health care here. They see this as a strategic move to be able to handle their health care costs at the same time just passing that burden on to the workers.
Barton says that in the past, nurses accepted lower pay for better benefits and believes her union is not only standing up for itself, but drawing a line in the sand for all employees whose health care is being threatened. No further talks are scheduled with a federal mediator. With the Workers Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner.
The highest military court in the nation has skirted the issue of whether laws against consensual homosexual sex are constitutional. In yesterday's unanimous ruling, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces denied an appeal based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision that essentially overturned state sodomy laws, Lawrence versus Texas. The military case, centered on a former Air Force sergeant who was convicted in military court 4 years ago on charges that included consensual sodomy, but focused on having sex with subordinate men in his chain of command, considered a more serious breach of military conduct. One airman testified that Sergeant Eric Markham might have taken advantage of him. The court said that any constitutional protections are therefore inapplicable. The court's decision leaves Article 125, the military ban on sodomy, intact. There are at least 9 other related military cases under appeal. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Pre-trial hearings for one of the 4 terrorism suspects held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, took place today. Human rights organizations and journalists have been allowed to witness proceedings, although access has been restricted. Selena Musuta has more on these controversial hearings.
It's Tuesday. The Guantanamo Bay Naval Base courtroom is full to its allowed capacity of 60 people. Only 8 journalists can be in the courtroom at a time. The rest must watch the proceedings on a monitor in another room. Salim Ahmed Hamdan of Yemen was the first of the 4 defendants to come before the 5-member military officer commission on Tuesday. Hamdan was Osama bin Laden's driver and is charged with 1 count of conspiracy. In the meantime, even Pentagon-appointed attorneys are still confused about how the commission works. This concerns human rights organizations who have been fighting for close to a year for more transparency in the commission process. Jemana Musa, an advocacy director of Amnesty International, is currently at the hearings on Guantanamo Bay. However, Monday night, Musa spoke to her co-worker, Alistair Hodgett, and detailed the limited access that human rights advocates have to basic court officials, like the presiding officer who is overseeing this case and who will be able to make a verdict with the rest of the commission.
The concern voiced yesterday was that in addition to observing the proceedings today, they had hoped to actually speak with court officials, and because they were denied in that, that is unfortunately a limitation on their ability to monitor the full compliance of the proceeding.
In a press briefing in Washington, D.C. last week, several of the human rights organizations who were sending representatives to Guantanamo Bay came together to brief the press on what to look for when posing questions to military officials. For Avi Cover of Human Rights First, the vagueness of the commission's court proceeding rules worries him. With rules constantly changing and setting precedents, Cover sees further opportunities for the abuse of detainees' legal rights.
The danger is, while currently the military commission rules state that it's only for non-citizens, there's certainly the possibility that they could one day be used for citizens, and also apparently how they will be used against non-citizens. Does it apply to individuals only captured on the battlefield? Does it involve individuals apprehended in the United States? Does it involve only individuals who are in the midst of a hostile act?
For John Lindsay Poland, military bases have a long and democratic past from Vieques to the Philippines. Guantanamo Bay is no different, says Lindsay Poland, coordinator for the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Task Force in Latin America and the Caribbean. Lindsay Poland sees the commissions at Guantanamo Bay and the detention of hundreds of people there as a calculated step in denying democracy and procedures of law.
But what's happening in Guantanamo Bay is that the U.S. is using it as an offshore detention facility that, because it's outside the United States, doesn't have U.S. laws applicable.
In addition to Saleh Mohamed Hamdan, the other defendants Al-Hamza Ahmed Suleiman Al-Bayul of Yemen and Ibrahim Ahmed Mahmoud Al-Kosi of Sudan are also charged with conspiracy. The 4th, David Hicks of Australia, is charged with conspiracy, attempted murder, and aiding the enemy. They will face the commission in preliminary hearings later on this week at Guantanamo Bay. All 4 defendants face a maximum of life in prison. However, acquittal does not mean automatic freedom. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Selena Masuta of the DC Radio Co-op.
Today, a high-level panel of former Pentagon officials released a report that criticized top current leaders for creating an environment that led to abuses at detainment centers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. The panel did not find, however, that the abuse was directly ordered by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld or Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Richard Myers. Mitch Jeserich reports from Washington, D.C.
A four-member panel reviewing U.S. detention operations, appointed by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, released its report faulting top officials at the Pentagon for creating conditions that led to prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib in Iraq, Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. While the report looks critically at Secretary Rumsfeld and the military's Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chair of the panel, former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger, was insistent that the abuses were not ordered by the Pentagon and that there was no explicit policy for torture.
The abuses that were depicted in the photos did not come from authorized interrogation. They did not come from seeking intelligence. They were freelance activities on the part of the night shift at Abu Ghraib.
The report says that abuses made famous by the photos of Abu Ghraib were caused only by a small number of people who worked the night shift. The report indicates that no such abuses occurred during the day and that the abuses in the photos were not part of interrogations. The report is critical of the top general in Iraq, Ricardo Sanchez, for allowing the abuses to continue even after he found out about them last November. Also blamed are the military personnel directly involved and Brigadier Janice Karpinski, who oversaw the prison. Still, with over 300 investigations into abuses throughout U.S. detention facilities, the authors of the report concede that prisoner abuse is widespread and beyond Abu Ghraib. Secretary Rumsfeld and the military joint chiefs of staff were faulted for allowing an atmosphere for abuse to exist and for not being clear on what interrogative methods were acceptable. Former Republican congressional member Tilly Fowler served on the panel.
We have chronicled in our report these leadership failures and the missed opportunities for effective and aggressive leadership and exercise of duty that could have prevented these abuses from happening. The warning signs were there, but they went unnoticed or were ignored. Time and again, we found examples of leaders failing to exercise the judgment, awareness, and resourcefulness necessary to recognize the magnitude of this problem.
Human rights groups have mixed feelings towards the report. On one hand, they applaud the panel for going beyond what Secretary Rumsfeld asked for it to do by investigating the roles of top officials. But they are also critical that the panel was created by the Pentagon. Both the Center for Constitutional Rights and Human Rights Watch are calling on the President and Congress to create an independent body to investigate the prisoner abuses. Eric Bill is Deputy Counsel for Human Rights First.
A lot of these investigations have been internal investigators who have limitations imposed on those to whom they can talk, where they can go, and what they're actually investigating. It's time to get beyond these individual investigations and recognize this as one of those moments that requires something much broader.
2 months ago, Human Rights First charged the Bush administration with maintaining 14 secret detention facilities worldwide that the International Red Cross does not have access to. Bill says it's vital that the information on prisoner abuse and detention centers, most of which is classified, is open to the public.
What we're talking about is a series of abuses, torture and other abuses that occurred in no small part because of the secrecy surrounding the institutions, the interrogation centers, particularly in light of what we understand is going to be further revelations in the Schlesinger report about so-called ghost detainees hidden from the system, because that's at the root of many of the abuses, the fact that these people are off-the-record detainees and there's no ability of their families or an independent institution like the ICRC to even know who they are, how they're being held.
On Wednesday, the Army is expected to release another report on detainee abuse. Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Archives of our program are available on the web at fsrn.org. Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mehdi army continue to resist against Iraqi National Guardsmen who are in day 20 of their attack on the holy city of Najaf. As the U.S.-appointed interim government struggles to seize the region, Iraq's education and environmental ministers have been targeted in separate car bomb attacks. Both attacks happened simultaneously in Baghdad, and although neither of the ministers were hurt, at least four other people were killed as a result. A band of insurgents linked to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi claimed responsibility for the strike against the environmental minister. Peggy Nish works with the Christian Peacemakers team. She joins us today from central Baghdad. Muqtada al-Sadr has been presented as a somewhat isolated figure of resistance in Iraq, but today we're reading reports that this latest attack of two ministers comes from another party altogether, that of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. What's the mood in Iraq at this hour? Is there a widespread feeling of resistance to the occupiers there?
I'd say that you still have a wide variety of viewpoints here in Iraq. You still have a very small minority of people who are still trying to give the United States a chance, who are saying, yes, we need to follow the U.S. leadership and are supportive. There's still people who will say that, but that group is getting smaller and smaller. I'd say probably the majority of people around Baghdad would say, we are not happy with what Americans are doing, but we want to give this new government a chance. And they say that we don't like what the more extreme resistance leaders are doing. Even if they want the U.S. to leave, they said this is not the way it should be done. And so most of the people say we don't like what Sadr is doing, and we don't like what Musakawi is doing. Now, if you leave Baghdad and you go out into southern Iraq, then you get a whole different story. But around this area of the country, you have a much more critical view of the leaders, of the more extreme leaders of the resistance. And these are even people that are not happy with what's going on. If you get down into, say, south of Baghdad, there's a lot more support for Muqtada al-Sadr and probably not as much for Zarqawi.
Staff Sergeant Ivan Frederick stands accused of participating in the torture that included having a hooded prisoner stand on a box with wires attached to him and told that he would be electrocuted if he moved. This, of course, happened at the Abu Ghraib prison. Today, Ivan Frederick pled guilty to charges in a pretrial hearing ahead of a court-martial in October. Are these cases being followed closely in Iraq, and do people feel that there will be justice for the horrors that occurred at the prison?
It really is being followed here. People have not forgotten. People talk about it. They were they felt somehow very good that it came out to light, that it was something that was being very hidden, and they were glad it was not just being swept under the rug. So that is something that has given the United States credibility, the fact that these people are being prosecuted. But we also hear a lot of skepticism among a lot of educated Iraqi people. Most of the people here all over the country get a variety of TV stations from around the Middle East, and so they hear news outside of, even from outside of Iraq. So they keep up on what's going on around the world. I think it's very important for the credibility of this, of the American presence here, to move ahead with this and demonstrate, fairness and demonstrate that they are really going to bring justice in these cases.
Peggy Nish works with the Christian Peacemakers team. We spoke to her today in central Baghdad. Guatemala has big plans for reducing its dependency on petroleum by turning its abundant rivers into a hydroelectric gold mine. But as the government proudly unveils plans for building three large dams, a heated conflict in rural eastern Guatemala is forcing the nation to think twice about hydro projects. Jill Roplogal reports from Rio Hondo, Zapaca, Guatemala.
In the dry, sweltering town of Rio Hondo in eastern Guatemala, local citizens and authorities are gathered to form an organization to defend their common lifeline, water. Ranchers, farmers, and town residents depend on the small rivers born in the lush heights of the Sierra de las Minas biosphere for drinking and irrigation water. That's why residents of the Pasabien watershed are outraged by a dam upstream from them which, they say, has ruined their once clean, abundant water supply. Rio Hondo Mayor Felipe Mendez blames the company that manages the dam for ignoring the people's problems.
The committees arrive to ask them for help, for burst pipes, or for broken levees, and most of the time they don't pay attention.
Some people say since the dam was built, they are now forced to buy drinking water trucked in from the nearby Pepsi plant. The experience has left Rio Hondo residents with a bad taste for hydroelectric projects. So when they found out two more projects are planned in adjacent watersheds, they put their foot down. Mauricio Vasquez bounds up the steep canyon of the Rio Colorado, leaving the town far below. As a Rio Hondo native, Vasquez knows and loves these mountains like his own children. As an agronomist, he knows just how important the rivers are to farmers and ranchers in the valley below. Vasquez says the potential environmental, social, and economic costs of a hydroelectric project planned for this river are higher than he and others in downstream communities want to risk.
In Rio Hondo, it rains around 400 millimeters per year. This is very little rain. So the only thing that provides us with water is this watershed.
But the companies behind the dam say concerns about decreasing water and water quality are false. Eduardo Barrientos is representative of the U.S.-based Hydro West, the international company that operates the Pasabien project. He says people exaggerate the problems with Pasabien. He says the real culprits are low rainfall, faulty pipes, and misuse of water.
I don't like to talk about the neighbors, but the people have been using water irrationally for 100 years. They divert the water, flood their lands, and then the water's gone.
Some environmental groups agree with the company. Oscar Nunez, director of the conservation organization that manages the biosphere above Rio Hondo, says that because no one in the municipality pays for water, waste is rampant. He says hydroelectric projects will ensure water and power for local industry and jobs for people. He also hopes that hydroelectric dams and other water users will provide funds for protecting water sources where the government has not.
After 13 to 14 years, we haven't received a single cent from the state of Guatemala for administering the area. To the extent that we obtain more investment in the Sierra de las Minas core zone from all water users, we are achieving more long-term sustainability for the environment and for human development.
Other environmentalists say Nunez's organization has a conflict of interest because they've taken money from the hydro company to do studies of the area. Also, locals say all the benefits from the project will go to the company because Guatemala already generates enough energy to meet demand. They vow to fight any attempts to start construction on the dam. Barrientos says Hydro West will just have to convince them or wait out the storm. The real battle may be yet to come. I'm Jill Replogle for Free Speech Radio News in Rio Hondo, Guatemala.
A custody battle between an African couple and a Texas lawmaker came to a close on Monday. The lawmaker had cited ethnicity, immigration status, and poverty as reasons he and his wife sought permanent custody of the couple's child. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Mother Miriam Kintamba and her 20-month-old son, Fidel Odimara Jr., were happily reunited Monday after a family district court judge's ruling. The judge found Texas Representative Talmadge Heflin had no legal standing to claim permanent custody of Fidel Odimara Jr. In court last week, Heflin said he and his wife, who are white, wanted the best possible future for Mrs. Kontamba's son. While testifying, Heflin said, quote, "We all know the terrible problem that black male children have growing up into manhood without being in prison," unquote. The custody battle began in July when Mrs. Kontamba refused the Heflin's request to sign papers and relinquish her parental rights. The Heflin's attorney explains how they came to know the child's mother.
Mrs. Heflin's sister, who worked with the mother, came to the Heflins and said, "I have a friend who has no place to live. Can you take her in?" And Janice Heflin talked to her husband, Talmadge Heflin. They said, "Yes, we open our home for this mother and child."
The Heflins say they were unaware Mrs. Kontamba was an undocumented immigrant from Uganda. They said they took care of Fidel while his mother worked outside their home. Whether or not Mrs. Kontamba was actually a domestic worker for the Heflins or a house guest is debated by both sides. Mrs. Kontamba had no legal representation in her struggle for child custody until social service providers at the hospital where her son received regular checkups suggested she contact attorney Matthew Nwagu. Following a hearing Friday in the custody case, Nwagu said his client was fighting an uphill battle.
The parties involved in this matter are too powerful and are highly connected, and they want to use that power to influence the outcome of this case. Hopefully, everything will work out to the best interest of the child.
The judge's ruling on Monday clearly indicated that despite the struggle waged by the Heflin's attorney, Texas law backs the mother's right to custody. Attorney Jolanda Jones helped represent Mrs. Kontamba. She spoke to reporters Friday before the judge's ruling.
And think of the precedents this sets. If people happen to be immigrants, if people happen to be poor, what is the precedent that someone with more money can come in and decide they don't like the way how the parents are supporting the kids and they can come take them? People who were poor grew up to be perfectly law-abiding, productive citizens. And that is what is going to happen in this case.
Jones says her client has a limited grasp of the English language and should have been assigned an interpreter before the custody hearings ever moved forward. The Heflin's attorney disputed this claim and described the interpreter request as a stalling technique. Meanwhile, Jones questioned why the Heflins ever had custody of her client's son.
I have never, in my almost 10 years of practice, seen a child removed from their parent without a hearing and given to a non-relative, non-custodial person. So I am also trying to figure out what went on when they didn't have lawyers.
Jones says she's reviewing her client's legal options as the parents take time to reunite with their child after a 7-month period of upheaval. With assistance from Alistair Machoka at KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feld for Free Speech Radio News.
You have been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in LA, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Lindsay Benedict. We have technical assistance from Eric Klein. For more information or archives of our newscasts, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. I'm Aura Bogado.